Coon Review, Print Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the Herald Scotland podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @CoonReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@coonreview.com. That is information@CUEANDREVIEW.com. Or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
The Herald Scotland, on Wednesday the 31st of January 2024. From the news section. UK aircraft carrier could be deployed to Red Sea. An article written by Jodie Harrison and read by me, Corey. The UK could send an aircraft carrier to the Red Sea as the threat from Iranian-backed Houthi rebels continues, the Armed Forces Minister has indicated. James Heapey suggested that a British aircraft carrier could be sent to the region to replace the USS Dwight D. Eisenhower when it is returned to America. The UK has already engaged in a series of airstrikes on Houthi targets in cooperation with the US, while the warship HMS Diamond is also stationed in the Red Sea to protect shipping in the key trading route. But Mr. Heapey, in an interview with The House magazine, suggested a UK aircraft carrier could plug a gap in the future. Referencing the nickname of the US carrier, he said, "There's no real need for more carrier mass. For more carriers to be in the region than the Ike can provide. She's a very capable ship." So our judgment was that with the Ike on station, the Eisenhower on station, and with jets available from Akrotiri, that we would be able to meet the challenge as it is now. He indicated the Royal Navy could step in when the Eisenhower goes home if we were needed to plug a gap in US deployments, or if the situation deteriorates and we need more. He added, "The fact is, the Eisenhower can't stay there forever, and so there's a thing about just maintaining a carrier presence in the region, where we might cooperate with the Americans to provide a capability there." Retired Admiral and Labour peer Lord West of Spithead has been among those suggesting UK could send an aircraft carrier to the region. The UK currently has two aircraft carriers in service, the HMS Queen Elizabeth and the HMS Prince of Wales. That article was from the Herald Scotland. It was from the news section. It was written by Jodie Harrison, and it was read by me, Corey. The Herald Scotland, on Wednesday the 31st of January 2024. From the news section. Why do some want to raise the school starting age? An article written by James McAnany and read by me, Corey. SNP MSP Kukab Stewart has submitted a parliamentary motion calling for an increased school starting age and the establishment of a universal kindergarten system in Scotland. Here, education writer James McAnany explains why some people believe that such a reform is necessary. What is the current situation? In Scotland, children can start school either at 4 or 5 years old, although attendance is not compulsory until the start of the school year after a child's 5th birthday. In practice, where a child's birthday fell before the start of January, they would generally be expected to start school at 4 years old, whereas those whose birthdays fell after that date would start school the following year. In recent years, however, more and more parents have been exercising their right to delay the point at which their child starts school. Campaigners from the Give Them Time group have recently celebrated their success in securing additional nursery funding for those who choose to defer school entry for children who have not yet turned five. Is the Scottish approach unusual? In a word, yes. A very small number of countries send children to school as young as 4 or 5, while the vast majority do so at 6 years old, and a significant minority wait until children are 7. In Europe, the overwhelmingly majority of countries send their children to school at 6, but some of those with particularly high-performing education systems, including Estonia, Finland, Poland, and Denmark, wait a further year. But we're talking about education here. Surely the sooner they start school, the better. Actually, that doesn't really seem to be the case. Various studies have shown little or no long-term benefit to starting schooling at a very young age, and there are concerns that doing so could have been having knock-on effects in areas like personal development and mental health. A much-cited study from New Zealand found that children who were taught to read from 5 years old did no better than those who started at 7, but that by the time they were 11, those ones who started later had a more positive attitude to reading in general. But what will children be doing if we wait longer to send them to school? Some people, especially those with young children, may worry about the implications of increasing the school starting age, especially if it means that they will need to spend more money on childcare. But a key part of this proposal is the establishment of a kindergarten system across the country. According to supporters, this new system would cater to children up to the age of 6. Replicating or even expanding upon existing levels of provision for those who have not yet reached school age, and replacing the hours that 4- and 5-year-olds would previously have spent in primary schools. Is this going to happen any time soon? Definitely not. The sort of changes that are being proposed would represent a major shift in the landscape of Scottish education, and it would take many years to make them a reality. Opening a universal kindergarten system would have implications for staffing in both terms of numbers of workers and the qualifications we would expect them to hold. If we want people to be able to become fully qualified, degree-holding kindergarten teachers, for example, we would need time to develop a programme for that, and then more time to allow enough people to successfully complete it. Even relatively modest changes in education can take a long time to implement, and a shift on the scale being proposed here couldn't be completed before the next election, or even before the next one after that. So, is it worth all the time and effort it would take? It just might be. Sometimes the things worth doing are difficult, after all, and building a better country for our children is something we should be willing to work for. It also makes sense to start at the beginning. In the last few years, we've heard plenty of promises of reform, but most of the focus has been on the latter years of high school. Perhaps it would be better to concentrate on getting the foundations right. We also know that the attainment gaps that have dominated the national education discussions and politics in recent years are not created at schools. They already exist by the time children set foot in their first classroom. The question to ask is whether or not we think that a reformed early years approach with a later school starting date and a universal, play-based kindergarten would make things better for children in Scotland. If the answer is yes, then how could reform not be worth the time and effort? That article was from the Herald Scotland. It was from the news section. It was written by James McAnaney and read by me, Corrie.
This is from the Herald Scotland on Thursday, the 1st of February, 2024, from the news section. Escaped monkey in the Highlands, spotted by drone. This article is written by Jodie Harrison. Experts searching for a monkey which escaped from a wildlife park 3 days ago have been able to follow his progress using drones. Keepers said that the Japanese macaque is making his way closer to the Highland Wildlife Park, which he left on Sunday, after finding a way out of his enclosure. With the help from BH Wildlife Consultancy, they were able to follow the macaque for 45 minutes on Tuesday using drones. However, he was not in a position from which they could retrieve him. Drone footage shows him roaming around underneath trees and sitting in undergrowth to have a look about before loping off. With a Met Office yellow warning of strong winds in place on Wednesday and gusts of up to 85 miles an hour possible, weather conditions will mean it is not possible to use the drones, though the Royal Zoological Society of Scotland, RZSS, said the search will continue. Keith Gilchrist, Living Collections Operations Manager at Highland Wildlife Park, said, "After continued help from BH Wildlife Consultancy, we were able to follow the macaque for 45 minutes yesterday using drones. Unfortunately, he wasn't in a position where we were confident we could bring him in safely, but he is making his way closer to the park. Our team will be out again today, but given the high winds, we won't be able to fly the drones, but we'll be using thermal imaging cameras. We're continuing to ask locals to please bring any obvious potential food sources like bird feeders or food waste inside. Although the macaque is not presumed dangerous to humans or pets, our advice is not to approach him, but to contact our hotline on 07933 928 377 with any sightings. The wildlife park, situated near Kingussie, houses a large group of Japanese macaques after successfully breeding the species. The Japanese macaque, also known as the snow monkey, is the most northerly living non-human primate, according to the RZSS. One couple who saw the monkey in their back garden at the weekend described the experience as so surreal. Carl Nagel, 49, and his partner Tina Salzberg, 50, saw the monkey from their patio doors in King Craig near Kingussie on Sunday morning. It nibbled on the nuts in their bird feeder and perched on their garden fence for about 15 minutes before running away. Ms. Salzberg, a chief strategy officer for a marketing consultancy company, told the PA news agency, "We were watching in awe, as it's so displaced to see a Japanese snow monkey in your garden, in a village in the middle of nowhere. It was absolutely wild. We were both elbowing each other, trying to get the other one out of the way, so we could get the best video and camera angles. It was incredible, I'm sure, once in a lifetime." Mr. Nagel said, "It's just the most surreal thing. I've seen snow monkeys in the wild, but you don't expect to see them in your back garden in the Highlands." That article was written by Jodie Harrison. This is from the Herald Scotland on Thursday, the 1st of February, 2024, from the news section. Puffins thrown lifeline by Scottish sand eel fishing ban. This article is written by Ginny Sanderson. Plans to ban industrial sand eel fishing in Scottish waters have been hailed as a lifeline for threatened seabirds like puffins. The Scottish Government on Wednesday, January the 31st, announced it intends to prohibit all vessels from fishing for sand eels, which are a critical part of the marine ecosystem. It comes as 70% of Scottish seabirds are reported to be in decline due to threats from climate change, unsustainable fishing, the rapid expansion of offshore renewables, and bird flu. RSPB Scotland described it as the greatest action that can be taken to offer seabirds a lifeline at a critical time. The charity said in a statement, "We are delighted that the Scottish Government has announced its intention to close Scottish waters to industrial sand eel fishing. We have championed this cause for over 25 years, and last year over 11,000 supporters voiced their support for this closure." The announcement, along with a similar closure announced for English waters of the North Sea, is the greatest action that can be taken right now to help our beleaguered seabirds and offers a lifeline at a critical time. Commercial fishing for sand eels, which provide a vital food source for many species, is currently only carried out by European vessels, as no fishing quota has been allocated for UK vessels since 2021. And it is understood 94% of sand eel fishing in Scottish waters is carried out by Danish fishers for animal feed. Mari Gujon, Cabinet Secretary for Rural Affairs, Land Reform and Islands, said, "Sand eel are a vital part of our marine ecosystem and a critical component of the food chain in the North Atlantic. It is critical that we manage our marine environment in such a way as to ensure its sustainable use, protecting biodiversity and ensuring a healthy, functioning ecosystem. Prohibiting all vessels from fishing for sand eel in Scottish waters will help provide long-term sustainability and benefits, not just for sand eel, but also for seabirds, marine animals, and other fish species. This decision reflects overwhelming support for our proposals, the scientific evidence base, and our long-standing position not to support fishing for sand eel as set out in Scotland's future fisheries management strategy." The Scottish Government said it consulted on proposals to close fishing for sand eel in Scottish waters in 2023, with 97% of respondents indicating support for it. It comes as the UK Government also indicated its intention to close Area 4 of the North Sea in English waters for sand eel fishing. The ban in Scottish waters has been announced ahead of the 2024 fishery season and is subject to parliamentary approval. The move has been praised as a proud day for puffins and a huge boost for Scotland's seabirds by the Scottish Greens. Ariane Burgess, MSP, spokesperson for coastal communities, said, "This is a huge boost for our seas and a proud day for Scotland's puffins, kittiwakes and other iconic seabirds. Sand eels are a vital life source for the seabirds who depend on them, and this will ensure a far greater and more sustainable supply in the future, while better protecting our marine environment. Scotland's fishers already stop this destructive practice, with the vast majority being done by Danish vessels. It is right and fair that the ban has been extended so that we can better protect our vital marine life." Puffins, which nest on the Isle of May and the Orkney and Shetland Isles, are facing rapid decline and are threatened with extinction due to the drastic reduction in food sources. In the UK, the birds rely heavily on sand eels, which have seen their population crash due to warming sea temperatures and commercial fishing. Meanwhile, kittiwakes are red-listed on the Conservation Concern Register, with their numbers having declined by 40% globally since the 1970s. The gulls, which can be found along North Sea coasts of Scotland, have been devastated by avian flu and overfishing of their staple diet, the sand eels. Numbers of breeding seabirds in Scotland have declined by almost 50% since the 1980s, Nature Scot reported in its later biodiversity indicator. Climate change is one of the major factors contributing towards this, with extreme weather destroying habitats and warming waters affecting food sources. This is compounded by overfishing as well as birds being killed as accidental bycatch, with 25 fulmars a day being killed this way, according to DEFRA. Other threats include invasive non-native species like rats eating birds and their young, and offshore renewables such as wind farms killing or injuring birds. That article was written by Ginny Sanderson. This is from the Herald Scotland, on Thursday the 1st of February 2024. From the news section. SNP accuses UK of total lack of focus after oil and gas licences. This article is written by David Ball. A senior SNP minister has accused the UK government of a total lack of focus on delivering a just transition for energy workers after 24 new North Sea oil and gas exploration licences were awarded. It is the second tranche of the North Sea Transition Authority's NSTA 33rd licensing round and follows 27 licences offered in the last allocation made in October last year. British multinationals such as Shell and BP are among the 17 companies which received licences in this latest round, with more expected to be confirmed in the coming months. The 74 blocks and part blocks offered this month are all in the central North Sea, northern North Sea and west of Shetland areas. The remaining blocks, the majority in the southern North Sea and East Irish Sea, will be offered when environmental evaluations have been finalised. An NSTA spokesperson said, "This latest batch brings total officers so far to 51, with more to come once the appropriate environmental checks are complete. These licences have the potential to make a significant contribution to the UK in energy production and economic benefits, and the NSTA will work alongside the licensees to help bring them into production as soon as possible." But the Scottish Government's Energy Secretary, Neil Gray, has criticised the move. While acknowledging the important and ongoing role that North Sea oil and gas plays in our energy system, Mr. Gray stressed that it is a declining resource and must be managed in a manner that is consistent with responding to the global climate emergency. He added, "Our focus is on Scotland's energy security needs, reducing emissions in line with our climate commitments and delivering affordable energy supplies whilst ensuring a just transition for our oil and gas workforce." In contrast, the UK government, which has responsibility for offshore oil and gas licensing, has shown a total lack of focus on delivering a just transition for the sector. "We have consistently called for the UK government's climate compatibility checkpoint to be strengthened. Without transparent and robust tests, we do not have a clear evidence base to assess whether new oil and gas licences should be issued on a case-by-case basis." The UK government should focus on its responsibilities and work with the Scottish Government to unlock Scotland's enormous renewables potential. UK Energy Minister Graham Stewart claimed it was common sense to make the most of our own resources, adding that domestically produced gas almost four times cleaner than importing liquefied natural gas from abroad. Fossil fuels imported from Norway have a lower carbon footprint than the UK's oil and gas sector. Mr. Stewart added, "These new licences will strengthen our energy security now and into the future, while also helping boost our economy by backing an industry that supports 200,000 jobs and is worth £16 billion each year." Friends of the Earth Scotland climate campaigner Alex Lee said, "This shameful decision to force through another licensing round shows the UK government has given up on any pretense that they have a shred of concern about climate breakdown. As storms rage and temperatures soar, the UK government is devoting its time and energy towards bolstering the obscene profits of major polluters rather than protecting the public they are meant to serve. They added, plans for new oil and gas are impeding the transition to renewables, diverting time and resources from where it is needed. All credible climate science says that we must urgently stop burning the oil and gas that is choking our planet. Workers need a real transition plan that can help them shift to secure green jobs, not political stunts that aim to further lock households into a fossil fuel system that is failing to provide either security and affordability. Offshore Energy's UK's OEUK CEO David Whitehouse said, "We all recognise that our energy mix must change, and our sector is ramping up renewables and accelerating the drive to net zero. But this journey will take time. Meanwhile, our North Sea basin is naturally declining. We have over 280 oil and gas fields. By the end of the decade, 180 of them will have stopped producing. We need the churn of licenses for an orderly transition that supports jobs and communities across the country and meets our energy needs." That article was written by David Ball. This is from the Herald Scotland on Thursday, the 1st of February, 2024, from the news section. Sturgeon regrets not locking down sooner as she apologises to bereaved. This article is written by David Ball. Nicola Sturgeon has revealed that not locking down a week or 2 weeks earlier, at the start of the pandemic, is a chief regret as part of an emotional evidence session in front of the UK COVID inquiry. The former First Minister became tearful at times while giving evidence in Edinburgh on Wednesday, including when saying a large part of her wishes she had not been Scotland's First Minister during the pandemic. She said, "Of the many regrets I have, probably chief of those is that we didn't lock down a week, 2 weeks earlier than we did." She denied making pandemic decisions for political reasons, adding she had not thought less about politics and Scottish independence in her life than she did during the pandemic. She added, "I was motivated solely by trying to do the best we could to keep people as safe as possible. We did that to some extent, but not to, and perhaps we never could have done it to the extent I would wish we could have done. I carry the regret for the loss of life, the loss of opportunity, the loss of education of our young people. I carry that with me every single day." Earlier, she choked back tears as she said, "I was the First Minister when the pandemic struck. There's a large part of me wishes that I hadn't been, but I was, and I wanted to be the best First Minister." Ms Sturgeon added, "It is for others to judge if she succeeded in her aim." UK Minister Michael Gove previously accused the Scottish Government of seeking political conflict during the pandemic. Ms Sturgeon, fighting back tears, said, "The idea that in those horrendous days, weeks, I was thinking of political opportunity was not the case." She said she felt fear and was overwhelmed by the scale of what we were dealing with in the early days. The Scottish Government became aware, the inquiry heard, that the COVID-19 was something to be very worried about in late January 2020, with the Cabinet discussing the virus for the first time on February the 4th that year. In another emotional segment of her evidence, Ms Sturgeon apologised to those in Scotland who suffered during the pandemic. She said, "I wish with every fibre of my being that the decisions my government had been able to take could have reduced the number of people in Scotland who did lose someone to COVID. I am deeply sorry to each and every bereaved person, and each and every person who suffered in other ways. I did my best, my government did our best, and people will judge that, but I know that every day I tried my best, and those working with me tried their best, to steer this country through the COVID pandemic in the best way we could. That article was written by David Ball.
From the Herald Scotland, Thursday the 1st of February, from the sports section, Albion Rovers striker Joe Bevan earns Burnley transfer. Article by Matthew Muir. Burnley have signed striker Joe Bevan from Albion Rovers for an undisclosed fee. The 19-year-old joined the Lowland League side in January of last year from East of Scotland club Camelon Juniors and leaves Coatbridge after scoring 15 times in over 40 appearances for the Wee Rovers. Bevan arrived at the Clifton Hill club, then managed by Brian Reid whilst amidst a relegation battle in Scottish League 2, and he converted 9 goals during the second half of the campaign. This season has seen the young prospect score for Sandy Clark's men in a Scottish Cup tie against University of Stirling, which was live on BBC Scotland, and, more recently, in a 3-1 victory against league leaders East Kilbride. After attracting interest from the Premier League club, Bevan spent a week's trial with the Clarets in December, and has agreed on a transfer to the Vincent Company side. He is understood to be joining their under-21 squad, who are currently 7th in the English Professional Development League Group A table, and have lost only one of their last 5 matches. Albion Rovers interim chairman, Bobby Cameron, said, "Joe is a fantastic young man, and everyone at Albion Rovers would like to wish him luck for his move to Burnley. Whilst we will be sad to see him go, other players will see how Albion Rovers is a club where the culture and environment support development, and that will help us to recruit others who have a great potential in the future, under the leadership of Sandy Clark and George Patterson. The deal we have agreed with Burnley is right for us as a football club. We also didn't want to stand in Joe's way, as this move is a wonderful opportunity for him. We'll be keeping a close eye on Joe, and we're sure we will see him shine." And that article was by Martin Muir.
This article, a selection of letters, is from the Herald on Thursday the 1st of February 2024, from the Opinion Voices section. The headline of the first letter, "Don't Blame SNP, UK and Brexit Have Worsened Highland Ills." Whilst I agree entirely with Kate Forbes's analysis of the problems of the Highlands, "We must all play part to fix crisis in the Highlands," says Forbes, the Herald, January 30th. I take issue with the rather narrow, one-sided views of Bill Eady, Letters, January 31, who seems to believe that long-standing problems are the fault of the SNP government. With relatives in Caithness, Easter Ross and the Black Isle, and being familiar with Wester Ross and Sutherland for more than 50 years, I know that roads, schools and ferry links to the islands are problems that have existed all that time. I constantly heard locals complain that they had been trying for 30 or 40 years to have problems solved, to no avail. Since devolution, I have travelled stretches of single-track, potholed road with sides crumbling, replaced by well-surfaced two-way roads with dangerous bends made safer, such as that from Achnacheen to Achnacellach or Loch Carron to Kishon. On these are signs saying "funded by Holyrood and the EU." I have also seen several stretches of the A9 north to Inverness duelled by similar funding. That further such improvements have now been held up is largely due to the withdrawal of EU regional funding after Brexit, which Westminster has not matched as promised. What part of this is the fault of the Scottish Government? Instead, a much smaller sum has been offered directly to local councils in breach of the devolution settlement, for which detailed plans for a capital project have to be vetted and approved by Michael Gove before funds are released as so-called levelling up. Councils have to spend substantial sums drawing up these plans, and during the 3 rounds of funding allocations, several have spent that money but have not had their project approved. Well, strangely, councils with a Tory MP have succeeded more than once. 40 years ago, I was told that 60% of the houses in Loch Carron were owned by wealthier folk down south, many regularly let out for holidays. At that time, I also knew a couple with two small children in a very small tied house who were desperate to buy a larger house locally with a small croft attached. This they had still not achieved by the time the children had left school, as they were always outbid by someone paying over the odds for a holiday property. So the families the area needs cannot find a home while the young locals move away. Meantime, the incomers damage the local economy further by driving on the improved roads to Inverness to stock up the freezer rather than buy at the local shop. What part of any of this is the fault of Holyrood or the SNP? While Westminster holds the purse strings and bases the Scottish budget on a population proportion of what it intends to spend in England, and Brexit has destroyed the alternative for additional funding. I, MacGregor, Falkirk. Time to remix the formula. Congratulations to you on your trenchant series of articles on the problems in the Highlands. What no article nor reader's letter has yet addressed is this, the Barnett formula. The block grant from the UK government is given to the devolved legislatures for them to spend it in any way they like. It goes into the general revenue account and is therefore not separately accounted for. Although not explicitly based on needs, the formula was an early attempt at levelling up at a time of future devolution. Estimates differ as to how much, but it certainly gives a financial benefit to the Scottish Government. If the extra money of the grant were hypothecated to specific purposes, for example, levelling up in areas of need, like the Highlands with its roads, ferries, schools, hospitals, etc., all serving a sparse population, this would serve the spirit and purpose of the formula better. Instead, the current government has utilised it for mass vote-winning schemes unavailable in England. Bruce Walker, Largs. Trains could be so much better. I fully support Ian Budd, letters January 31st, in his views on the Far North Railway lines and his comments on the inner city lines between Aberdeen, Inverness and Glasgow, Edinburgh and Stirling. I would add to that my great concern about the West Highland lines to Oban, Fort William and Mulaig. All these railway lines are vastly underfunded and have been since I was working in the West Highlands for British Rail just before rail privatisation in 1994. Just last year, I had the experience of travelling by rail from Zurich in Switzerland to Tirano in Italy over the Bernina Pass. Superb scenery, comparable with Scotland, but the train service is so much better, with modern, comfortable trains that have large observation windows. We really should be ashamed of ourselves here in Scotland. We could and should do so much better. It would, of course, be easier to do better if prominent politicians, such as Kate Forbes, were to travel by train. She does excellent work in supporting the Highlands, but if she were to use the train for that long journey from Dingwall, or at least Inverness, to Edinburgh, it would take away some of that stress of driving on the A9. The HST trains that run on that line are very comfy. We need to get more people travelling by train rather than by road, and we need our politicians to be in that modal shift too. Patricia Fort, Glasgow. Lowland areas suffering too. I have enjoyed your series on the new Highland clearances. However, I have been struck by one thing. The issues facing the Highlands are also faced by many lowland areas. As a former community councillor in Inverclyde and currently in Ayrshire, I have been able to observe and experience firsthand here the same issues faced by the Highlands. In terms of hospitals, the services provided by the Inverclyde Royal Hospital have steadily and systematically been downgraded. Whether removal of ICU beds or downgrading of maternity services, Inverclyde residents have no option but to travel the journey up to Glasgow, whether themselves or by ambulance, in the same manner of those in the north. South Ayrshire faces the same effects of centralising services and is losing its ICU beds. In terms of jobs, the Lowland-deprived areas have and are suffering in the same way as the residents of Kinlochleven. Our nuclear power plant is closed and in a generation will support very few jobs, and there are no plans to even talk about how we could replace it. IBM is all but gone from Spango Valley in Greenock, joining the shipyards in the dustbin of history. Plans for new cable manufacturing facilities at Hunterston have been met with complete apathy from North Ayrshire Council and its elected members, despite North Ayrshire being one of the most deprived areas in Scotland, and the STEP bid at Ardeer was purely a tick-box exercise, despite the huge opportunity there. Rail services in the last year have, through various dubious means, been downgraded to and from Largs, with journey times no better than the era of steam, something which has affected many areas outside the Golden Railroads from Glasgow to Edinburgh. Across North Ayrshire, the council is making moves to close the last remaining public toilets, ostensibly to be put into community ownership, whilst knowing there are few groups able to take them on. Ironically, North Ayrshire Council put these plans to its cabinet on the same day it voted to adopt a tourism strategy for North Ayrshire. In a further synergy with Fort William, Largs Community Council recently piloted a community cinema, which was a resounding success. Young and old clearly were pleased to travel 5 minutes to see the flicks, rather than make the journey up to Paisley or Glasgow, something which is nigh impossible without a car in the evenings. Despite living in close proximity to large urban areas, there is little to keep young people in our areas and encourage them to stay and start families. It seems like politicians only really care about the big cities. Rural dwellers, whether Highland or Lowland, get a raw deal, but it is the wider country that will suffer in the long term. Jamie Black, Largs. That was a selection of letters from today's Herald.
This is from the Herald Scotland on Friday, the 2nd of February, 2024. From the news section, Anne Call, woman arrested over death of 61-year-old in Rutherglen. Article by Jodie Harrison. A woman has been arrested in connection with the death of a 61-year-old in Rutherglen. Anne Call was found with serious injuries at a property in Newfield Place at around 12:45 a.m. on Friday the 22nd of December last year. She was pronounced dead at the scene and her death was treated as suspicious following a post-mortem examination. Following inquiries, officers have arrested a 37-year-old woman in connection with her death. Police Scotland said that further inquiries remain ongoing. That article was by Jodie Harrison. This is from the Herald Scotland on Friday, the 2nd of February, 2024. From the news section, Robertson to launch independence paper with focus on culture. Article by Kathleen Nutt, political correspondent. Angus Robertson will today unveil the latest Scottish Government's paper making the case for independence with a focus on culture and the arts. The External Affairs Secretary is expected to argue that independence could enhance Scotland's rich culture sector by removing travel barriers for artists between the country and the European Union. He will also argue independence will see the sector thrive economically while unlocking freedom of movement with EU membership. In the 10th paper of the Scottish Government's Building a New Scotland series, which will launch in Glasgow this afternoon, ministers argue the priceless assets of the country's culture sector will lead to a successful independent nation. The minister will say, "Culture is one of Scotland's priceless assets, and we are determined to protect and enhance it, putting it at the heart of our communities for the benefit of everyone. These strong foundations could help us become a successful, inclusive, vibrant,
independent nation. Our ambition is to rejoin the EU as a member state in our own right as soon as possible. This would mean regaining the immense benefits of free movement of people and the networks that support the exchange of ideas upon which culture thrives. It is more important than ever that Scotland has the powers necessary to support and develop our cultural and creative sectors, to ensure that creative professionals can work and collaborate with their peers around the world, and ensure that everyone in Scotland can fully benefit from our rich and diverse culture. Previous papers in the Building a New Scotland series have focused on the EU membership, the economy, the constitution, migration and citizenship, the marine sector and social security. First Minister and SNP leader Hamza Yousaf last month launched his party's general election campaign with a bid to oust the Scottish Conservatives' 6 MPs. He also made a bid to win back independence supporters who may be switching their allegiance to Labour. Research has shown that while support for independence remains around 50%, some Yes supporters are considering switching to back Scottish Labour. A poll last weekend gave Scottish Labour its biggest lead over the SNP for almost a decade. The research by Norsta put Labour on 36%, up 3 points since its last poll in October, with the SNP on 33%, down 4 points in terms of Westminster voting intentions. In his first major speech of the new year, Anas Sarwar, the Scottish Labour leader, urged independence supporters to deflect from the SNP to boot the Tories out of Downing Street. But the SNP leader, launching his party's general election campaign in Glasgow, had a blunt message for those whom polls indicate are drifting towards Labour. If you believe decisions about Scotland should be taken in Scotland, if you believe in independence, then you must vote SNP. If you want to see an independent Scotland, you have to get out and vote for it. Mr Yousaf said UK Labour leader Keir Starmer doesn't need Scotland to win the election. Mr Starmer has described his party's victory over the SNP at the Rutherglen and Hamilton by-election last October as a milestone on its route back to Downing Street. Mr Sarwar has said that electing more Labour MPs would maximise Scottish influence. But countering this, the SNP's Westminster leader, Stephen Flynn, said that any Scottish Labour MPs elected would take independence off the table as soon as they got to the Commons. Meanwhile, Labour Deputy Leader Angela Rayner will join Mr Sarwar in East Lothian on the campaign trail today. Ahead of her visit, she said the SNP-led Scottish Government is distracted and tired. Ms Rayner is aiming to promote the party's New Deal for Working People, which would bring in changes to employment law if Labour wins power at Westminster. The party has pledged to ban exploitative zero-hours contracts, as well as fire and rehire practices, and abolish anti-union laws passed by the Conservatives. That article was by Kathleen Nutt.
From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 5th of February, from the news section, exclusive, Cancer Research UK pledges £750,000 for Scotland trial nurses. This article is by Helen McArdle, health correspondent. Scotland is to receive a share of £5.9 million to ensure that two senior research nurses can continue working on cancer clinical trials. Cancer Research UK confirmed today that it is allocating £749,336 to fund the two positions, one in Glasgow and one in Edinburgh, over the next 5 years. Laura Rooney, the Glasgow-based CRUK nurse, has worked in clinical research for the past 15 years. She described her role, which involves helping to set up and run clinical trials for cancer patients in the NHS Greater Glasgow and Clyde, as a special privilege. Based between the Beats and West of Scotland Cancer Centre and the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital in Glasgow, a critical part of her role is raising awareness of clinical trials among the health community, patients and the public. Ms. Rooney said, "Being able to support patients gaining access to experimental new treatments can offer them hope, but it is also invaluable in informing future drug development and research. Clinical trials offer the best path to new and more effective treatments for patients now and in the future." Ms. Rooney has been pivotal in a number of key clinical trials offered to Scots patients, including Determine, the largest study ever funded by the charity into so-called precision medicine, where treatments are matched to individual patients. The ongoing trials exploring whether drugs already used for the other cancer types can be used to treat rare forms of cancer, or common cancers with unusual genetic mutations, where patients have exhausted other options. If successful, those medicines could then be quickly approved to treat other patients with the same rare cancer across the UK. Cancer Research UK currently funds 15 senior research nurses across the UK, including in Scotland, Wales, London, Birmingham, Manchester, Liverpool, Cambridge, Newcastle, Oxford and Southampton. They play a critical role in helping people affected by cancer gain access to clinical trials which offer patients, some of whom have few remaining treatment options, the opportunity to try new therapies which, if effective, can be adopted more widely for others. These roles act as a key liaison between researchers, health professionals and patients, and help to both raise awareness of cancer clinical trials and support delivery of trials within the NHS. The Glasgow and Edinburgh nurses work closely with each city's Experimental Cancer Medicine Centre, ECMC, which run clinical trials for patients with cancer in Scotland. Anne Crowdas, Cancer Research UK's lead research nurse, said, "We are delighted to announce this renewed funding for our senior research nurses who perform an invaluable role in Scotland and across the UK. This demonstrates our commitment to offering and recruiting patients to clinical trials wherever possible for patients with cancer. Clinical trials offer opportunities for new and more effective treatments for cancer and provide hope for patients now and in the future." And the article was an exclusive by Helen McArdle. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 5th of February, from the news section, Church of Scotland urges public to challenge hostile migrant rhetoric, report by Jodie Harrison. A church leader is urging the public to call out people who use hostile or dehumanising language towards migrants. The Right Reverend Sally Foster Fulton, moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland, said uttering such language diminishes humanity and is not to be challenged when overheard. The moderator said she believes everyone has a responsibility to create a world where every person is treated with dignity and respect, but racism, discrimination and prejudice is preventing this outcome. She was speaking ahead of Racial Justice Sunday on February the 11th, which provides churches across the UK the opportunity to discuss the unwelcome presence of racism in society and commit to try to stamp it out. The day of action comes after a former Labour minister last month told the House of Commons she felt asylum seekers in the UK currently face a similar hostile environment to Jewish refugees fleeing persecution during the Second World War. Dame Margaret Hodge, who lost close relatives during the Holocaust, warned MPs, "The language you use today matters," and criticised those who speak of asylum seekers invading Britain during the annual Holocaust Memorial Day debate. Recent Home Office figures show more than 1,000 migrants have arrived in the UK so far this year after crossing the Channel. The provisional annual total for last year was 29,437, which was lower than the record 45,774 crossings counted in 2022. The moderator said, "Migration has been an important part of Scotland's story. Over the centuries, many Scots left to start new lives in places like Canada and the USA, and, in turn, many people have come to Scotland to make it their home. Sadly, over the past few years, we have seen increasingly hostile and dehumanising language levelled at migrants, refugees and asylum seekers. People coming to the UK have been branded as criminals, as scroungers and even as part of an invasion. This abuse can be found in the pages of newspapers, comments online, and increasingly from the mouths of our politicians. It's become so common that we almost don't notice it anymore. Ms. Foster Fulton, who grew up in South Carolina in the USA and moved to Scotland more than 30 years ago after marrying a British citizen, said it is clear not all migrants are treated the same. It's our responsibility to create a world where every person is treated with dignity and respect, she said. It's especially important in a dangerous world that we ensure that everyone who comes to the UK fleeing war and persecution is granted a generous welcome. The moderator went on to urge the public to watch out for family, friends, work colleagues and even local newspapers using dehumanising language to describe or refer to migrants. When you hear it, call it out, she said. If we let this become part of our normal way of seeing a huge section of the global population, we diminish both our humanity and theirs. Report by Jodie Harrison. From the Herald Scotland, Saturday the 3rd of February, from the news section, Stagecoach bus driver dies after assault at the Elgin bus station. Report by Craig Williams. A bus driver has died after an alleged assault at the Scots bus station. Police were called to Elgin bus station late on Friday evening following a report of an assault. Emergency services also attended and a 58-year-old man was taken by ambulance to Dr. Grace Hospital, where he later died. A 15-year-old boy has been arrested in connection with the alleged incident, police said. Stagecoach North Scotland confirmed that the man who died was a driver with the company and said it is assisting police with an investigation. A spokesperson for Stagecoach North Scotland said, "We are shocked and saddened by this news and our immediate thoughts are with the family and friends of our driver who has sadly passed away. Safety is our number one priority and incidents like this are extremely rare. We are doing everything we can to support our colleagues and our driver's family, as well as assisting the police in their investigation." Jeremy Fernandez, councillor for Elgin City North, added, "I am deeply saddened and outraged by the tragic incident that occurred at the Elgin bus station. My heart goes out to the family, friends and colleagues of the victim during this unimaginably difficult time." Police said inquiries are ongoing. A Police Scotland spokesperson said, "Around 10:40 p.m. on Friday the 2nd of February 2024, police were called to the St Giles Road area of Elgin following a report of the assault of a 58-year-old man. Emergency services attended and the man was taken to Dr Grace Hospital in Elgin, where he later died. A 15-year-old male youth has been arrested in connection with the incident and inquiries are continuing." Stagecoach North stated on social media that there is a major disruption to its service as a result of the police presence at Elgin bus station. In the meantime, the bus company has advised passengers to seek alternative transport. And that report was by Greg Williams. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 5th of February, in the news section, "Who cares? Scotland report on the promise shows lack of progress." Article by Katrina Stewart. As many as 4 in 5 social workers were absent due to sickness last year in one Scottish local authority, new figures show. Some 83% of social workers at one council had days off, nearly 20 percentage points higher than 2 years ago, according to data obtained by the charity Who Cares Scotland. Today marks 4 years since the publication of The Promise, a flagship report commissioned to spearhead a root and branch review of Scotland's care system. It was a hallmark of Nicola Sturgeon's tenure as First Minister, yet many of the first phase of recommendations of The Promise, which should have been delivered in 2021-24, are delayed or watered down. Louise Hunter, Chief Executive at Who Cares Scotland, said, "This is a critical time for the care experience community. It has been 7 years since Nicola Sturgeon announced that root and branch review of the care system in Scotland. And we're now 4 years down the line since the publication of The Promise. It's clear there's still lots to do. We want to make sure that Scotland is aware of the progress, highlight concerns from the care experience community, and motivate everyone to work together to uphold the commitments set out in The Promise. Together, we can make sure care experienced people have a lifetime of equality, respect and love. A new report from Who Cares Scotland, which uses data obtained under the Freedom of Information legislation, highlights concerns about the lack of progress, data gaps and dilution in aims. The promise was the end result of a 3-year review, the independent care review, of the care system and received cross-party support. Its recommendations are to be implemented by the organisation The Promise Scotland. However, the Promise Oversight Board, the watchdog organisation overseeing the work, stated in June 2023 that it was not on track and planned 2021-24 would not be successful. Who Cares? Scotland's report, Is Scotland Keeping the Promise? Highlights concerns on the lack of progress in education, restraint and the monetisation of care. Not every local authority responded to the FOI requests, and the report does not name individual local authorities, nor give a breakdown of figures relating to each council. A spokeswoman for Who Cares Scotland said the report was not intended as a criticism of any one council, but as a report card of progress Scotland-wide. Some 26 councils responded to a request asking for the amount of money spent on providing residential children's care to profit-making companies. Of those, 15 councils have spent £218,383,947 on outsourcing care to private firms, and 14 stated they had no plans to stop using profit-making companies to deliver care services. This counters a stated aim of the promise, which is that Scotland must avoid the monetisation of the care of children and prevent the marketisation of care. Angus, Dundee, Moray and Shetland councils have all stopped the use of profit-making companies. The report also shows 2023 had the highest level of sickness absence among social workers, with the rates rising steadily from 65.2% in 2021 in the council area with the highest number, to 77.9% in 2022 and 83.3% last year. These numbers represent different local authority areas, and Who Cares Scotland would not reveal which council returned the figure of 83.3%. The report reads, social work staff are at the forefront of the lives of children and young people who are in or around Scotland's care system. That supporting workforce needs to be supported in itself. However, our research reveals that across Scotland, social workers have a challengingly high level of sickness absence. This level of absence could have an impact on the quality of service that care experienced people receive. It might lead to difficulties maintaining a consistent relationship with them and be moved around different workers. The report also condemns education sectors for using reduced timetables to exclude care experienced pupils from school, with 20 local authorities using reduced timetables and 18 saying there is no date to end this practice. Reduced timetables can be used by schools to support school refusers to attend some rather than no classes. But Who Cares Scotland said the practice is a way of informally excluding care experienced pupils from education. Who Cares Scotland said that it heard anecdotally that the reduction in 2020 to 2022 of nearly 2,000 children being received into the care system had been hailed as a positive indicator of success of the promise, which aims to keep children and young people out of the care system where possible. The report adds, more work needs to be done to understand if this statistic can be claimed as a success or if it's a worrying failure. This is especially critical given the restricted access that social workers and other council services had to families during this time due to the pandemic restrictions and high absence rates. In that article was by Katrina Stewart.
This is from the Herald Scotland on Monday the 5th of February 2024 from Voices section. Scotland going in wrong direction on tax. Article by Dominic Ryan. Two of the country's leading business people have warned Scotland will suffer if it does not replicate UK tax cuts. Entrepreneur Sir Tom Hunter noted, the latest reports suggest Chancellor Jeremy Hunt has a UK budget coming out on March the 6th, and they reckon he has about £14 billion of fiscal headroom.
That just means he has £14 billion to play with. So, another 2% cut in national insurance would cost about £9 billion, and a 2p cut in income tax would cost about £13.7 billion. But we need to remember, our wonderful Scottish Government has introduced 6 different rates of income tax. We are higher than England and the rest of the UK. And I believe our First Minister has said, if England cuts income tax, he's not going to follow. I really believe this Scottish Government is taking our country in the wrong direction. Fellow entrepreneur Lord Willie Hoy agreed with this analysis, but questioned whether the Chancellor should be more concerned about predictions for the lack of growth in the UK over the next 2 years. There are various different numbers that have come up, from 1.6% to 3.2%, he said. But we have said it for weeks. If we want to tackle all the problems we have, especially the debt problem, it should be all about growth. Sir Tom agreed, adding, yes, it should be. The IMF are saying Britain is going to be the second worst off nation in the G7, the only one, which is unbelievable. Worse than us is Germany. And Germany's been a big exporting country, and it's been a big growth economy. The IMF is also saying the UK should spend our tax on education and infrastructure to encourage growth and an energy transition. Now, I kind of agree with that, but we're in the election year, and financial decisions will be made for political outcomes. That article was by Dominic Ryan.
This is from the Herald Scotland, on Monday, the 5th of February, 2024. From Voices section. Social care workers deserve parity with NHS equivalents. Article by Joe Long. Scotland's social care staffing crisis is acute and is showing no signs of improving anytime soon. The recent budget announcement from the Scottish Government will do little to help. Experienced and knowledgeable practitioners are leaving third sector service providers like Scottish Autism, for whom I work, in their droves. Staff who were already burned out by the demands of the COVID pandemic are now working in services where turnover is high and pleased to cover extra shifts come thick and fast. It is unsurprising that many are choosing to join the exodus. This instability and churn is acutely felt by the people supported in these services, many of whom have lifelong support needs and feel disoriented by the constant changes to their support staff. We expect social care staff to have the right values to support vulnerable people and a knowledge base that draws on disciplines as wide-ranging as psychology, health and speech and language therapy. Many staff are expected to work autonomously or provide one-to-one support. Yet few local authority contracts with third sector providers allow for a salary more than the social care living wage. A survey of Scottish Autism staff recently showed that practitioners were suffering acute levels of financial stress, severely affecting their well-being. Many frontline care workers could not afford leisure activities or socialising. Others were cutting back on activities for their children, and some struggled to pay rent, eat well, or pay for public transport. From April, the social care living wage for Scotland will be set at £12 per hour, lagging well behind pay rises in the NHS and education, and well behind stark cost of living rises. An NHS worker on Ban 3 salary currently earns over £4,000 a year more than the social care living wage. The ever-widening gulf between social care and NHS salaries presents a significant challenge to staff retention in care and reflects wider inequalities in esteem between sectors. The NHS is rightly valued by the public. Its staff deserve the pay rises they have received. Yet social care is all too often the poor relation, overlooked, or seen simply as a pressure valve that can help to improve hospital discharge rates.
Diversity and specialism within the sector is rarely recognised. This disparity in esteem is reflected in the way that we value and reward workers. While Scottish Autism supports calls for a £13 hourly wage from April, arguing for specific figures will simply lead to perpetual campaigning and debate as the cost of living rises. A starting point for any serious solution should be parity with NHS Band 3 as a minimum social care salary. The Scottish Government must consider benchmarking of this kind as a sustainable response to the current staffing crisis. How we as a country value those people who require social care is reflected in how we value those that care for them. If we are to have a professional, knowledgeable and sustainable workforce in social care, we need to offer fair work within a respected and properly compensated sector. Joe Long, Director of Practice Innovation, Scottish Autism.
From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 5th of February, from the Arts section, Lancome issues reward for missing viola after Glasgow Barrowland gig. Article by Katrina Stewart. Irish band Lancome has posted a reward for the safe return of two instruments that went missing following a gig in Glasgow. The four-piece performed at the Barrowland venue as part of this year's Celtic Connections Festival. However, last night the group posted on the social media platform X that a fiddle and viola had disappeared at around midnight between the Barrowland and the Hilton Doubletree Hotel in Cambridge Street. Both instruments were contained in the same case and belonged to the Dublin bands Cormac McDiarmada. The group has offered a reward for their safe return. This year was the 31st Celtic Connections, a world-renowned folk, roots and world music festival that ran for 18 days with more than 300 events involving 1,200 artists across 25 of the city's venues. The biggest winter festival of its kind in Europe, the festival hosted more than 115,000 attendees. And that report was by Katrina Stewart. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 5th of February, from the business section, Gravitricity to demonstrate energy storage tech in deep mine. This article is by Ian McConnell. A Scottish company aims to demonstrate its gravity energy storage technology at full scale in one of Europe's deepest mines near a small town in central Finland. Gravitricity said the plan to transform a disused mine shaft into an underground energy store, using its technology, could offer new opportunities for the remote community of Pihajärvi. The Edinburgh company has developed an energy storage system known as Gravistore, which raises and lowers heavy weights in underground shafts, which it says offers some of the best characteristics of lithium-ion batteries and pumped hydro storage. Gravitricity said, the community of Pihajärvi, which is 5,000 inhabitants, lies 450 kilometres north of Finland's capital, Helsinki. Nearby lies Pihasalmi Mine, Europe's deepest zinc and copper mine, owned by First Quantum Minerals, a Canadian mining corporation, and descending 1,444 metres into the earth. Many of the mine's operations have now ended. Gravitricity noted its technology uses heavy weights suspended in deep shafts by cables attached to winches. When there is excess electricity, for example, on a windy day, the weight is winched to the top of the shaft ready to generate power. This weight can then be released when required, in less than a second, and the winches become generators, producing either a large burst of electricity quickly, or releasing it more slowly depending on what is needed. The local community set up a special development company, called Kallio Pihajärvi, to promote regeneration projects at the historic mine, of which the Graviscore scheme will be part, Gravitricity noted. The Edinburgh company said, the two organisations have now signed an agreement to transform a 550-metre deep auxiliary shaft into a full-scale prototype of Gravitricity's technology, and anticipate this could become Europe's first gravity-stored deployment. It added that the scheme being developed would deliver up to 2 megawatts of storage capacity, declaring, "This would tie straight into the local electricity grid and provide balancing services to the Finnish network." Gravitrisseri noted that it last year signed an agreement with Swedish-Swiss energy multinational ABB to use ABB's mine hoist expertise to help accelerate the adoption of underground energy storage. It added that it anticipated ABB would lend its expertise to the project alongside Gravitrisseri's other strategic partner, Dutch wind specialist Huisman. Gravitrisseri executive chairman Martin Wright said, "This project will demonstrate at full scale how our technology can offer reliable, long-life energy storage that can capture and store energy during periods of low demand and release it rapidly when required. This full-scale project will provide a pathway to other commercial projects and allow our solution to be embedded into mine decommissioning activities, offering a potential future for mines approaching the end of their original service life." He added, "It will also provide vital low-carbon jobs in an area which has suffered significantly from the end of traditional mining operations." And that article was by Ian McConnell.
The Herald on the 6th of February and the news section. Andrew Bowie loses government pylons job after raising pylons fears, by David Ball. A Scottish Tory MP has lost his government responsibility for pylon building after campaigning against new pylons in his constituency. Andrew Bowie, a UK government energy minister, has been quietly moved from his role of overseeing national plans to build more pylons after being put in charge of the brief in February last year. Politico reported that the West Aberdeenshire and Kincardine MP had his brief for pylons quietly passed to fellow Energy Minister Graeme Stewart. Mr. Bowie has kept hold of his responsibility for nuclear power and has taken on more scope for renewables as part of the swap with Mr. Stewart. According to Politico, the UK government confirmed that Mr. Bowie has raised potential conflicts of interest under the ministerial code, recording a large number of energy companies and organisations working in or on behalf of the energy sector within the minister's constituency and surrounding constituencies. In July 2023, while he held responsibility for the pylons policy, Mr. Bowie wrote that concerns raised by his constituents over a proposed new substation and pylons were a priority of mine. He added it was evident that SSEN, the developer, had made mistakes in their engagement with the local community. Mr. Bowie also met with the local anti-pylon campaigners before and after holding the brief. In November, Mr. Bowie's boss, UK Energy Secretary Claire Coutinhoe, suggested that MPs face difficult conversations with constituents about the local impact as the UK government looks to radically expand the electricity grid in preparation for more green energy sources moving online. Mr. Bowie is defending a very slender majority in West Aberdeenshire and Kincardine of just 843 at this year's general election. While the new minister responsible for pylons, Mr. Stewart, has a majority of more than 20,000 in his Beverley and Holderness constituency. The MP, who was previously Theresa May's parliamentary private secretary, has also served as Minister for Exports and the International Trade Department before switching to his energy role. Tim Durrant, Programme Director at the Institute for Government think tank, told Politico, "There's a requirement in the ministerial code for ministers to avoid any conflict of interest between constituency issues and their departmental responsibilities. The code explicitly says responsibilities should be arranged to avoid any conflict, so it could be because of that that they've moved things around in DESNZ. Scottish Renewables said it's time to be upfront and honest about the need for updated infrastructure. It said previous work by the UK National Grid is estimated 5 times more transmission lines needed to be built by 2030 than have been built in the past 30 years at a cost of more than £50 billion. And that was by David Ball. The Herald on the 6th of February and the news section. Delivery driver robbed at gunpoint in Edinburgh incident, by Gabriel Mackay. A man was robbed at gunpoint in Edinburgh as he delivered a takeaway. The moped driver was dropping off an order at a property in Murrayburn Gardens at around 10:55 p.m. on Monday, February 5. Having walked towards the door, he noticed a young male sitting on his vehicle. After asking the young man to get off, another appeared and threatened him with what appeared to be a firearm. The pair took the victim's phone and moped keys and made off with the vehicle, heading along Murrayburn Gardens towards Westside Plaza. The first suspect is described as a white male, aged 15 to 16 years old, of skinny build and wearing a black balaclava, black jacket, black joggers, black shoes and black gloves. He had a Scottish accent and was softly spoken. The second suspect is described as a white male, aged 15 to 16 years old, 5'9", of skinny build and wearing a black balaclava, black jacket, black joggers, black shoes and black gloves. He's also had a Scottish accent and was softly spoken. Detective Inspector Kevin Tate said, "This was a terrifying experience for the victim and it was vital that we trace the two individuals responsible. We are appealing for anyone who was in the Murrayburn Gardens or the surrounding area on Monday evening who may have noticed anything suspicious to please get in touch. We'd also urge anyone with private CCTV or dash cam footage of two males riding on a moped in the Wester Hills area to pass this on to officers. Anyone with information is asked to contact Police Scotland on 101, quoting incident number 3790 of Monday, 5 February 2024. Alternatively, you can call Crime Stoppers anonymously on 0800 555 111. That was by Gabriel Mackay. The Herald on the 6th of February and the news section. Kwasi Kwarteng quits as MP, eclipsing Liz Truss popcorn launch, by Tom Gordon. The man Liz Truss sacked as Chancellor has announced he's leaving Parliament, undermining his old boss's launch of a new right-wing Tory faction. Kwasi Kwarteng, who oversaw Mrs. Truss's disastrous mini-budget in 2022, said he would step down as MP for Spelthorne in Surrey at the election, a seat he has held since 2010. His announcement came just hours before Ms. Truss was due at the launch of her popular Conservative group dubbed the Popcorns at Westminster. Ms. Truss sacked Mr. Kwarteng after he spent just 38 days at the Treasury, a decision he learned about on Twitter after being recalled to the UK from Washington, D.C. It followed his mini-budget, causing market turmoil and a surge in interest rates because of unfunded tax cuts he and successor Jeremy Hunt had to drop. Mr. Kwarteng's exit was a reminder of the chaos during Ms. Truss's 49 days at number 10 and suggested a lack of belief in the Tories under Rishi Sunak winning the general election. The launch of the Popcorns also highlighted splits within the Tories at Westminster, despite the Prime Minister repeatedly warning his MPs that voters reject divided parties. As well as his predecessor, the faction includes former Tory Deputy Chairman Lee Anderson, who recently quit his party for all in a disagreement over the Rwandan asylum policy. The right-wing grouping is trying to push the PM to cut taxes, adopt hardline policies on immigration, and leave the European Convention on Human Rights, ECHR. Reform UK founder Nigel Farage attended the event, saying it was partly because he was covering for GB News, not because he wanted to join the Tories at the moment. He told PA, "I'm motivated and interested by ideas. That's why I was in UKIP and not the Conservative Party. I suspect I would agree with a lot of what is said on the platform this morning, but none of it is going to be Conservative manifesto policy." And that's really the point here. Whilst there were some big names like Liz Truss, Jacob Rees-Mogg, I saw Priti Patel coming into the audience earlier, they are a very small minority within the Parliamentary Conservative Party. He added, "I'm not looking to join the Tory party. You must be joking. Not at the moment, given what they stand for. And as far as this group's concerned, I'd rather be part of Reform because that's the real thing." Popcorn's leader, Mark Littlewood, a close ally of Ms. Truss, said the group wanted to influence Tory manifesto at the general election. He kicked off the launch by blaming quangos and bureaucrats hampering Tory aims. Despite many of those involved being unhappy with Mr. Sunak, he told an audience in Westminster's Emmanuel Centre, this isn't about leadership of the Conservative Party. It was not about seeking to replicate or replace any of the existing right-wing caucuses of Tory MPs, he continued, but would be a genuinely grassroots movement. Many of the Conservative aims, such as low taxes, have proven to be frustratingly elusive, he said, saying a hostile institutional framework was against achieving these goals. The POTCOMs aimed to tackle quangos and bureaucrats who share the same sort of leftist groupthink and were sneering about ordinary people's beliefs, he said. Former Cabinet Minister Sir Jacob Rees-Mogg also spoke at the event, where he criticised an activist judiciary and an out-of-touch oligarchy. Declaring the age of Davos man is over, the multimillionaire old Etonian said voters had enough of international cabals and quangos telling hundreds of millions of people to how to lead their lives. North East Somerset MP said bodies such as the World Health Organization and COP Climate Summit limit our freedom for manoeuvre. We have to restore power to our democratic institutions and take it away from those that seek to override democracy, Sir Jacob told the event. Judges are tied to the international elite and unaccountable, unelected quangos are plugged into EU lawmaking, he said. We need to re-establish the traditional relationship between the judiciary and the parliament. Ideally, we should bring it back into parliament. The former business secretary argued the UK system, the apex of power being the king in parliament, had been eroded in recent years by an activist judiciary exemplified by the living document theory of the ECHR. Sir Jacob denied the grouping was seeking to oust Mr. Sunak, who has failed to overturn Labour's significant poll lead. But he has said he would like to see Mr. Farage join the Conservative Party. Work and Pension Secretary Mel Stride suggested the Popular Conservatives' launch was a sign of the broad church within the party, rather than open division. He told GP News, the Conservative Party is a very broad church, there are lots of ideas, and I think it's important that the different parts of the party do come together and ventilate different views as to how we best move forward as a political party. We've always been adapting through history. That's why we're one of the longest living and most successful political parties in the world. So I welcome all of this kind of debate. Green MSP Maggie Chapman said Kwasi Kwarteng stepping down is long overdue. He did an immense amount of damage in a very short time, and we're also still paying for his failings. It shows how worried the Tories are when even he is abandoning the sinking ship. He was the worst Chancellor in UK history, and it would have been good to see the electorate booting him out of Westminster. It's telling that he would rather leave on his own terms rather than facing the indignity of the impending wipeout. His will undoubtedly be the first in a run of fearful Tory MPs who will quit in the weeks and months ahead as they face political oblivion. The sooner the Prime Minister calls a general election to speed up their departure, the better. And that was by Tom Gordon.
That concludes this week's edition of the Herald Scotland podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Hear and Review and tell your friends about our service.